This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, the best-selling Irish single malt in the U.S. The Sexton is an unexpected modern malt for the everyman, rich in hue, approachable in taste, and memorable in character. Learn more at thesexton.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
Hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, June 13th, 2018. This is the 180th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a top writer, editor, and podcaster, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip. Later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to not judge a book by its cover. Something we've all heard before, yet sometimes forget. It's easy to look at someone and form an opinion based on looks alone. However, appearances only say so much about a person. And certainly not the whole story. So never assume that someone's outside matches their inside, or that anyone's life is perfect, as we all have flaws or cracks. Leonard Cohen wrote, "There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." Let's remember that and do our best not to judge or compare, and rather appreciate what we have and others too. That's my tip today. Now, I'm very happy to have my guest here with me in the studio. It is Howie Kahn. He is a writer and contributing editor at the Wall Street Journal. He is also the host and editor-in-chief of Prince Street Podcast and the co-author of his first book, Sneakers, a New York Times bestseller. Howie has contributed to publications including Details, GQ, The New York Times, Travel and Leisure, and Food and Wine. He is a James Beard Award winner and a graduate of University of Michigan, Go Blue, and Sarah Lawrence College MFA program. Welcome, Howie.
Hi, Sherry. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on my show. It's great to have you.
Good PR tip. It's kind of a life tip, isn't it?
Thank you. My PR tips are often life tips.
Yeah, they straddle both.
They do, I think. And yeah, I'm glad you liked it. I was thinking, how did I get to 180 episodes and not use that tip before?
I know. Well, I don't know if we think about that enough. You know, yeah. that gratitude piece, right? We're all rushing around doing our thing every day and maintaining our life and our families and our jobs and maybe friendships if there's time, and pressing like on Instagram, and gratitude, like, unless Oprah reminds you or Sherry Bayer reminds you, it's sometimes something that doesn't get into the everyday, which is unfortunate. And you're right, it's something to keep tabs on.
Wow. Yeah, I agree. I'm glad you liked it. I'm speechless. You compared me to Oprah. that's a good start of the show.
You get a PR tip.
So I said go blue, and I feel we've talked about Michigan because I think we have. I'm a graduate too.
Go blue.
Yeah. So I don't know, like, what led you to go to University of Michigan and then graduate and get into writing?
Well, I'm from Michigan.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't one of those out-of-state situations where I chose it for some reason, like my camp counselor wore the shorts a lot when I was a kid, or like an older cousin went there. It was really close to where I was, and I think if you grew up in Michigan, when I was growing up in Michigan, a lot of people stayed home. You stayed near where you were. Midwesterners stayed in the Midwest at that point in time. I liked going to Michigan. It was fun. I think I went there for the football team.
I went for the basketball team. Me too. I mean, I went for lots of reasons, for the academics, for the sports, for the social life. But I'm from Miami, and people thought it was nuts. Like, what are you doing in Michigan?
Yeah.
So
paying that beautiful out-of-state tuition so us in-state kids could go for super cheap.
Yeah. Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bayer.
So we both went to Michigan. I didn't know what I wanted to do at the time when I was a basic liberal arts degree. But did you know you wanted to get into writing?
I figured it out towards the end. I started out in a pre-med type curriculum, and it was just awful. I couldn't bear getting out of bed to go to these science lectures in 1,000-person halls with, you know, some guy with a super nasal voice and a perpetual cold and a bow tie that matched his socks talking about covalent bonds. It just wasn't exciting. Writing came through as I went on, but there is a food link. The reason I do what I do now is very linked to something that happened in college, and it wasn't any of my classes, because they don't teach, you know, food writing. There was, because it's Michigan, Jim Harrison popped into the curriculum every now and again, as he was somebody who lived in the Upper Peninsula. And of course, Hemingway lived in northern Michigan for a period of his life. So that was... That would float into the curriculum every now and then. But I worked at a really great deli. I worked at Zingerman's.
Did you?
Yeah. And that was kind of this big turning point. I mean, when I think back on what happened in college, there were two professors who were really important and knew I could write before I knew. They just kind of spotted it and nurtured it. And they were great, and I owe them so much. But the thing that turned it in this direction was that job.
Of course. I know Zingerman's, but I didn't know you worked there.
It's an incredible place to work, because the way you're trained to do the job is so largely narrative. I mean, it was the first place I ever realized that food was largely about stories. You know, they bring these foods in there, and they were teaching us, and this is 1998, 1999. You know, they were talking about raw milk cheese producers from France, and I think selling the cheese illegally at the time, and dry goods from Italy that they were bringing back. And there was so much adventure and spirit to their travels and their stories that I was mesmerized by the fact that they could go all these places because they wanted to find the perfect dry spaghetti or the perfect piquillo pepper somewhere in Spain. You could get a raise at the job after checking off a certain number of boxes. And I think it was called like the Zingerman staff passport at the time. It was the size of a passport. It might've been a guidebook, but I'm just going to go with passport. And it was purple and passport size. And there were boxes you could check. And they were for things like mastering how to slice prosciutto San Daniele, or how to slice smoked fish like the guys at Zabar. So you would master all these skills. And while you were mastering the sort of skills and the techniques of selling perishable foods, you'd learn who caught the fish and who cured the ham. And then you got to tell the customers the stories. And it was really fun. It was really fun. It was a great job.
I'm sure it was. And it led you into food writing.
Yeah, it was a great... I mean, I I wish I could still go back there and work there for one day. Just take on.
They'd probably let you
take on one more shift.
Have you written about Zimmerman's?
I've never written about it. I like to talk about it all the time. But my, I worked the Sunday morning shift. I opened the store on Sunday mornings, and I would show up probably around five. I mean, what kind of college kid wants to open a deli at 5:30 in the morning? Me, you know, I would get there and the bagel delivery would be there, and then they were making all their breads fresh in their bakehouse, and the bread delivery would come on, and my manager at the time was making, again, this is like 1999, he was doing pour over coffee. I had never seen pour over coffee. You know, the coffee that I saw that was that instant was Folgers, and all these worlds were just opening up all the time. It was very cool.
So after college, did you stay in Ann Arbor?
No, I left.
Did you
come
to New York?
I'm having these flashbacks now of like job instructions. Like, can you go get that wheel of Parmesan like out of the walk-in? And we'd go back and get like a 75-pound wheel of cheese, and then they'd show us like how to crack the cheese with the little knives and where to tap it and how to move around it, and then wrapping all the different cuts. It was awesome. I left Ann Arbor as soon as I possibly could. I mean, I think I ate my way through everything at Zingerman's, and I think one of the reasons why I felt like I had to get out of Ann Arbor is after living in a place, small town, for 4 years like that, I kind of felt like I was out of things to eat. I was always going to leave, but I really remember very strongly like driving around there with my college roommates just searching for new food.
Don't you? Now I'm thinking of a chapati.
Chapatis are good. Yeah, so a chapati is.
We had pretty good food in Ann Arbor. I mean, it's a small town, but.
No, we really did. Chapati is a salad dressed with like really good Italian red wine vinegar dressing inside a chapati.
Giant
but it's
pita.
Like. It's a very fluffy, fluffy bread, and the top they rip off, and it's like a salad in a bread bowl with a bread top.
We
salad
lived
with a bread
on those
uniform.
In my house of
were
roommates.
You now there were two places that did chapatis, right? There was the Pizza House chapati, and then there was like a competing chapati. Where I don't even remember what it was from because
I'm blanking on the name, is right nearby.
Yeah.
Amir's. Amir's was another place we went to.
Amir's was like a more Middle
we're
Eastern.
Get stuck on.
No, Amir's was like a Middle Eastern deli. Yeah. They had a great like baba ganoush and hummus, and I think that they had ice cream too. I think they had really good pistachio ice cream.
Yeah, we had Stucci's.
Stucci's was the ice cream place. I think, I don't know what Ann Arbor's like now. I have this like nightmare scenario in my head where it's all just like one big bank or a bunch of Walmart type stores next to each other. I mean, Borders was a big anchor there. It's closed. I don't know if Shaman Drum bookstore is there anymore. I don't think it is.
I don't know. I went back a couple years ago for a game. I need to go again.
Yeah.
I'll give a report.
Please do. Live podcast from the Michigan tailgate.
We have to do it. But, I mean, we could spend the whole show, and we kind of are, talking about Michigan.
I like how it went from go blue to go Zingerman's.
But just a little. Where'd you move after?
Here.
I moved to New York.
Yeah, I went to grad school at Sarah Lawrence. I think one of my nice Michigan professors was able to somehow get me into a MFA writing program. Which was great. I knew I wanted to move here. I knew that I wasn't going to have anything like a publishing career in Michigan because there was no way to learn how to do that then. There weren't really blogs. People were writing like super confessional first-person memoirs. Everybody wanted to be Dave Eggers. So I moved to New York and I went to Sarah Lawrence to do a nonfiction degree, which was great.
Did you ever work in-house for a publication, or have you always been freelance?
I've always been freelance, but I worked at GQ every day for probably 5 or 6 years as a fact checker mostly.
Okay.
Yeah. My very first job, though, was at Sever.
Oh.
I got an internship my first semester of graduate school, and the office was on 23rd and Park, and Coleman Andrews was the editor-in-chief. At the time, I was like 23.
I went in there once and tested recipes when I was dabbling in different jobs, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. We overlapped in our career moves a little bit.
I got yelled at once for not... a box of macarons came from, I think, La Ray. There for him. I was opening the mail. I was the intern, and so I was going to bring him his box of cookies into his office. And one of the kind of middle editor stopped me, like, what are you doing? And showed me how to arrange the cookies on a silver platter for Coleman Andrews. And I was just like, no, I'm not ever doing that. There's going to be no cookie arranging on silver platters for anybody ever in my career.
No, but as a freelancer,
yeah,
there's a lot of pitching involved.
There's a lot of pitching.
And is that, I mean, did you always want to be, why have
no,
you chosen
I didn't.
To be?
No, I didn't. I remember in grad school, like when I realized like people either have staff jobs or freelance jobs, I still didn't know I was going to be a journalist. I was writing experimental first person garbage prose that I don't know how they let me do this. A lot of my professors were journalists, and it kind of a light went on in my head one day. I was like, oh, that's how I'm going to make a career doing this. I'm going to be a journalist. I'm not going to be a writer, whatever that means. And so I started trying to do job things like getting internships, learning how to tell stories. I started pitching stories. And when you start pitching stories, at least when I started pitching stories, the first thing you hear a lot is just no.
Well, I'm a publicist, so I can relate.
No. No. I remember saying to one of my coworkers, like really early on, I was just like a dumb kid. How much rejection can a person take? You know, really entitled garbage. And she looked at me really dead in the face. She was a little older than me. Not incredibly worldly. And she said, Howie, a lot. And I was like, oh. And it was really such a turning point. It was this really pivotal, like, slap in the face. Something I should have known anyways.
Yeah, but...
You know, you grow up, if you're lucky, sometimes in these very protected places.
True. Was there a story that you wrote or that you pitched that you got a yes to that you feel, like, was your break?
Yeah, there definitely was one. I remember... I was writing a travel guide story about the food scene in Portland, Oregon, when there wasn't much of a food scene in Portland, Oregon, just a few places, but it was really starting to happen in a really organic way. And I was having dinner with Michael Hebb and Naomi Pomeroy. It was at that point in their careers where they had combined their names and they were going by Heberoy, and they had these great restaurants. And I was sitting next to Michael, and we were just talking about people, and he was talking about Jim Denovan, who does Outstanding in the Field, the sort of travels around in an old Volkswagen bus, sets up dinners on farms. This is like 2005. There wasn't really a term farm to table. People didn't really care about chefs in like a regional way. People knew the chefs who were on the Food Network. People knew, and at the time it was like David Rosengarten and Mario Batali and what's her name? She also went to the University of Michigan, Sarah Moulton, who was so great, like every day at 4 o'clock.
So good on TV.
And the idea, yeah, she was so good. What's Sarah Moulton doing?
She's on, I'm going to have her on my show.
You
I'm
should.
Still connected with her.
Episode Sarah's 181, awesome. Sarah Moulton.
Sarah, I'm reaching
my
out
God.
To you.
I mean, she was just a force. I learned so much about food from Sarah Moulton, really.
Yeah.
But anyways, Michael knew Jim, who had done like 5 farm dinners or something at that point. He was doing like 4 or 5 a year. Now he does like 60 and like has a car, gets car commercials. I thought it was so cool that there was this idea of this wandering chef, which is what the piece was called, essentially. And I pitched it to GQ, where I was working every day at the time, fact-checking a lot of stories, including all of Alan Richman's stories at the time.
Oh, wow.
So that was the trajectory, right? So from Zingerman's to Sarah Lawrence to the Sever internship to Zingerman's, I mean, to GQ, where my first boss there, who was the head of the research department, asked me, like, which writers do you want to work with? And Richman was the one I was reading, you know, at the time, more than anyone else, because I was interested in food and this idea of stories, and I thought he was cranky and hilarious and insightful and well-traveled and wise. And so I started working with Alan, and then I thought, maybe I should try to write one of these food stories. So I pitched a bunch of stuff, no, and eventually this Jim Denovan story got through. And I remember I was so excited. I was so happy. I remember leaving the office and like taking a victory lap around Bryant Park. Like I was, I just like, you know, it's that New York moment in the movies when something great happens to somebody for the first time and you feel like, wow, everything's going to change. And, you know, you're at that age when you're still sort of idealistic and you think one thing can change everything. It really doesn't happen like that. It's like more like slow incremental upticks and setbacks for the course of a career. But oh, it's fun to talk about that moment because it was such a high. So I went out and reported this story. Again, I think it was 2006. Magazines were really good. You know, if you worked at the office late, they'd send you home in a car that they paid for. You could report a story until the cows came home, however long you needed, you know? And so I went on a trip with Jim for like 2 weeks, you know, traveling around the Western United States. Now it's like, you know, they want the stories done as soon as possible. They don't stack stories as much as they used to. They don't like have a big inventory. So now it's like you go, you report a story, you come home, you write it. It's very efficient. Back then it was a lot more romantic. Other kind of reporting still takes long periods of time. I mean, I think about somebody like Pam Koloff, who's writing these incredible criminal justice stories that take her a year to report. And just, you know, tip of the hat there. But in 2006, having 14 days or whatever to report a food story. And then probably another. Then he came to the East Coast, and I think I hung out with him here for a little while. I really got into the reporting, and I loved writing the story. And then it got nominated for a James Beard Award. And then I won.
That's incredible.
It was.
That's the win that I talked about. Yeah, I didn't know what the win was. The win was that first. Win. Yes. Wow. Amazing.
It wasn't the very. Well, not the it first, wasn't the very the first one, thing, but it was irrationally early.
Yeah. Yeah. That's incredible.
It was great. It was great. And then the second, then the my follow up to that story. And this was a great lesson, too. Got killed the day it was shipping to the printer. Because the restaurant I was writing about went out of business because it was a fish restaurant in London, and the guy was way ahead of the curve with sustainability and was doing all this sort of dock to dish stuff before there was that term, and he was affecting policy in the UK. And he was doing fast food also, Tom Akins. And he called me right at the end of the story. He's like, I have to close the restaurant. And it was, I think, because some guy who was his neighbor, someone with a title, Lord or whatever, was getting some fish stink into his flat, you know, in Chelsea. So it was some real estate drama that ended up shutting down the story. So that's the job. You know, you go from the high of winning some big award to like thinking you've done some other great thing. And then it gets killed because like some rich guy in London doesn't like the smell of his, you know, foyer or whatever.
Fascinating.
Ups and downs, ups and downs.
Yeah.
Up, down.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a little break here. Come back. We'll talk more with Howie about everything he's doing. Well, I want to get a little into the podcast, too, and hear about that. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
I'm Souther Teague of Moria Margo and co-host of The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, a new and unexpected modern malt for the everyman. The whiskey is made from 100% Irish malted barley, triple distilled for smoothness in copper pot stills, and consciously aged for 4 years in Oloroso sherry butts. My favorite part about the Sexton is that sherry influence from those Oloroso sherry butts. They're the large sherry barrels that have been used. And then the whiskey gets aged in them for 4 years, giving them this sort of nutty, almost savory quality. The copper pot still makes for an extremely smooth finish. I like it in a highball or just neat. Every time I have a sip, I want another one. So next time you're gathered with friends or posted up at your favorite bar, reach for the Sexton, the best-selling Irish single malt in North America. You can learn more at thesexton.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Howie Kahn. He's a writer, contributing editor, and he's the host and editor-in-chief of a podcast, Prince Street Podcast. Why don't we talk about that a little bit?
That's
how'd you get into that?
I auditioned. It was this show. Dean and DeLuca sponsored it. Sponsors it. It's still ongoing, and they were looking for somebody. My name was thrown in the hat somehow, and somehow I got that job. I think I convinced somebody that I could do something I never tried to do before. It was great. It was
at Heritage.
It was at a really critical time too. It was the show launched 2 months after my son was born, and I really wanted to do something that anchored me in New York for a lot of the first year of his life. I was really traveling a lot, and I didn't want to be on the road that much with a newborn baby. I just wanted to be around. So sometimes the things you need to happen pop up.
Yeah, true.
You grab them,
true.
You know?
So how often are you doing the show, and what's the format? Because I've listened. It's great, but it's different than here where we're doing it live.
We're a little restless. I mean, we've changed it up a bunch of times. We started out doing it as monthly podcasts, then we went to twice a month, then we went back to once a month, then we went back to twice a month. The format at the beginning was it had a lot of segments. I think some of our shows at the beginning had like 6 segments or something like that.
I remember that.
We tightened it up. We went to like 2 or 3. Now we do some shows where it's just one. We do some shows where it's one with like a little bit at the end. We did this Madeline moment thing, which is about a food memory. You know, something you fondly remember that takes you back to a period in time in your life that was important or whatever. We just try to have fun with it. We try to mix it up. Our show is not live, and in fact, it's very tightly edited. I mean, we do the thing where sometimes we take an hour interview and we turn it, you know, whittle it down to the best 15 minutes and rearrange the order of the questions and try to form a narrative so, you know, people kind of hear beginning, middle, and end of something. But I love it. I love the format. I love talking to people. I'm much more comfortable being on your side of the mic and asking the questions. It's after that, during the commercial break, I was like, whoa, I'm talking a lot. During my show, I kind of bite my tongue a lot because I want the other people to talk.
Yeah. It's no, it's good. Me. It's good to be on the other side.
Yeah.
So in the editing, are you involved in that process?
I have been. Okay. I mean, it's the kind of thing where we take, you know, we take transcripts, we get them transcribed, we cut them up. You can't just rely on the transcripts because it's audio and certain things can't be cut out and certain things sound a certain way. And so you have to know what can go where. But it's like this fun puzzle. You know, we X out things, we move things around. The editing can be tricky. You know, you also always want people to sound like themselves. You don't want to change that.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, there's pros and cons to, I think, both live and versus edited. But
yeah,
but,
no, it's been super surprising.
But your show's great. I've listened to many of them.
I love doing it. Thank you for listening.
You're welcome.
You and my mom.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you have two listeners.
I know.
Let me ask you about this book you just wrote.
Let's talk about that book.
Sneakers.
Yeah.
Why?
So it's literally sneakers, like you know, the shoes.
Yeah.
Not some like literary title about people who are doing things in the backwoods or you know, anything like that. It's about sneaker culture. I just find it fascinating. I find it's a lot like food, actually. It's a lot like the food world. People are very detail-oriented and particular. Designers are very artistic, and they try to tell stories through their shoes. It turns on a lot of people, and it's a huge, huge business.
Huge. I mean, are you a sneaker... Or were you a fanatic? Like, I mean, do you have like a whole closet of
not as much
sneakers?
Not as much as some people. Yeah. I mean, I certainly have more now than when I started. I think I think there's been a tipping point where I now have more sneakers than I have condiments, and I am a condiment fanatic as well. But now I surprisingly, and I didn't expect this to happen, I have more shoes. I like them.
Well, I see your next book, the condiments,
and then that
will beat out.
Or even like a product line where it's like, you know, the little tiny sneaker like ramekins that hold condiments. Or, well, actually, one of the guys in my book, John Buscemi, who has a really high end line of sneakers called Buscemi, you know, like amazing Italian leather, really handcrafted. He just launched a line of hot sauce called Truff. T-R-U-F-F, and it's like a truffle hot sauce. It's really good. He's also like a partner in the deli, Polly G's or something. It's in L.A.
Oh,
Polly's, Polly G's. Polly G's is the pizza place.
Polly G's is here. In
Greenpoint. It might also be called Polly G's.
He uses
Well, he's the honey on the pizza.
Sauce.
But John's place is a deli, and there's definitely, like, sneaker people love food. David Chang did a shoe last year with Nike. He has a Momofuku high top. People went crazy for it.
Yeah, I remember. It was awesome. I remember that.
It was really cool.
So this is a perfect segue into my question from my last guest. On episode 179, I had on Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of James Beard Foundation. And he was talking about how your worlds collided back. He wrote some articles for GQ.
I used to fact check him. Yeah. I used to have to call Mitchell, who, like, knows everything about everything. And and be like, are you sure this pancake recipe, like a pancake recipe? I'm asking Mitchell Davis to fact check his pancake recipe. I'm just trying to be earnest about my job. And of course, because he's, like, super polite and professional, he's like, yes, yeah, you know what I mean? But yeah, we go way back. Mitchell's great.
Yeah, he is. So his question is, as fine dining has casualized and chefs no longer wear white coats, dress pants, and leather shoes, but rather they're wearing aprons and sneakers, can you look at a chef's sneakers and know anything about the way that person cooks?
Probably. I mean, not a lot of chefs are wearing sneakers in the kitchen, although there are some. Like, John and Vinny did a collab with Vans, I think. The guy from Number 7 Subs did a collab. Chang did a collab.
He also pointed out, and I remember this, how John George was an article about him, how he wore Prada shoes.
Yeah.
But I don't think
I don't know how you'd wear Prada shoes in a kitchen. Like,
well, it's John George.
Slide all over the place. I think you can tell certain things about people's personality from their sneakers. I think there's a care with which people pick out the shoes that they're wearing. So if someone's wearing, like, like a pair of retro Jordans or something, like, I would be willing to bet that that person also might be someone who's, like, fermenting things for a long time. Like, they're interested in, like, the history and the funk and, like, making things old and cool. So I think that's probably true. You can also kind of tell, like, I think, like, Roy Choi wears Air Force Ones a lot, which are, like, a classic Nike silhouette and, like, really simple one colorway. I think he wears white on white a lot. And, like, a person like that's usually, like, really honest, like, just telling it like it is. And his cuisine's, like, a really straightforward representation of what he cares about. So I think there are certain things, certain conclusions you can draw. The best pair of sneakers in the food world that I've seen is Billy Peel, who's one of the... I think he's the general manager of 11 Madison Park, has a pair of one of one Jordans that were made for him by, I think, his cousin who works at Nike, with the 11 Madison Park logo embossed on them in gold leaf.
Oh,
these shoes are ridiculous.
That is
They're
fancy.
Amazing. They're amazing. And I tell Billy, I'm like, why don't you wear those during service? And they have a uniform. So, you know, I don't know if he's going to get away with high tops on the floor, but they're really beautiful
shoes.
Unless
they made them for the whole team.
Which,
in a sense,
hey, Nike.
I could see 11 Madison or that group, the Nomad group, like,
doing. Yeah, they should. Eddie Wang
the
has
made
a
nice sneaker.
Eddie Wang has a collab with Adidas. I mean, this thing with chefs and sneakers, I think we'll probably see more of that. I hope we do.
Okay. You've heard it here.
Yeah. Angela Dimayuga also is like a big sneaker person. I'm kind of waiting for her to put her imprint on something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to take another break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to play my speed round game and talk some industry news. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Howie Kahn. It's time for my speed round game.
Uh-oh.
think you're going to be good at this.
So fast.
It's called speed round. So I'm going to name a couple things and you pick your preference as fast as you can.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Depends where I am. If I'm in New York, I like eating at home. If I'm traveling, always out.
That's an original one. I like it. How about wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
That's really difficult. Today I'm feeling beer.
Okay. Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Right now I like super large plates.
Super large.
Yeah, I like that. Like you know, like the lasagna for what, however many people at Don Angie. Like these big format, these big format plates. I want to see it get bigger. Major Domo is doing some fun big plates, like bigger. I like family style stuff.
Okay.
People need to share.
I really like Don Angie's.
Me too.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Chef's counter.
Tipping or all inclusive charge?
I like tipping.
You like tipping. How about high tops or slip-ons?
Ooh, high tops. I'm wearing some right now.
Writing or podcasting? sorry. Stumping you?
Ooh, I guess writing.
You're doing it longer, but yeah.
Yeah. Can't do one without the other, really. I write a lot for my show.
Yeah, true. How about cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
You live in Brooklyn too?
I do.
Awesome. That's the game.
How'd I do?
I think you did really well.
What do I win?
Well, my show, the winning prize is kind of lame because...
Actually, you gave me a hat.
I did give you a hat.
I got a hat.
You won a hat.
I won even before I played.
Because everyone on my show is a winner.
It's a cool hat. Cool. All in the industry has cool swag.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm glad you like it. Okay, so it's time for industry news.
Okay.
You know, normally I wait until the night before my show to pick my news story. I did not have to do that this week.
No.
Because, so, you know, I think everyone knows, the industry knows, and the world knows that Anthony Bourdain passed away last Friday, and he committed suicide. It was extremely tragic news, and I've been having a hard time with it.
Me too.
I know I didn't know him. Like, I met him a couple times. I'd been to many panels and things that he'd been on. But I didn't really know him, and I feel I'm very affected. I know you've written many articles on him. I've listened to your podcast where you had him on.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know how...
You know, I'm like everybody else. I'm really sad and stung and... you know, suicide's a confusing thing to wrap your head around. You start asking a lot of questions about how and why, and then you kind of remember that you're not going to get the answers. It's not something you can really report out necessarily. And I did get to spend some time with him over the years, including a recent piece I wrote for WSJ Magazine. He was a dream subject.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just so open. He respected the craft. He knew what went into it. I mean, this is somebody who was a chef for his whole life before he really made it. And he really made it as a writer. I think he had to have the experience of those years in the kitchen to write about, but he really made his name being a communicator and a storyteller. So when you would approach him to do a story, he would just handle it with the utmost seriousness. And it was a kind of empathy because he knew what it was like to be doing that and to be the person who had to produce the story or the content. And because of that, he was just so open. It was really something to behold. Subjects aren't like that necessarily. It's not par for the course.
Yeah, true. I don't even know what I want to say about it. I feel he's influenced so many people, and I felt, I don't know, this weekend I felt I wanted to go by Layal, so yeah. I did, and just to see, I mean, there's so many people have gone by there, as a tribute to him and leaving notes and leaving flowers. And mm-hmm. you see how he's just, it's not just people in the food world that he's made an impression on.
No, and I hope it's not just, you know, people in the food world who he continues to make an impression on. It's terrible that he's gone. But we do have a lot of stuff left behind in terms of writing that's going to be valid forever. His show, things he's filmed, talks he's given, podcasts he's been on. You know, there's a way in which that voice remains resonant, and all the things he championed, we can get right back to them by reading his stuff and listening and watching. And then that's, you know, there's a little to take comfort in this whole thing, but there is that stuff remaining. I mean, he can still be a guide to us in all of those ways. There's still a way to go where he went, because he did. He opened all these doors.
He totally did.
He did amazing things for people. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons people connected with him. I think it was because of his honesty. I think people saw a lot of their own sort of personal struggles in him. And there was sort of the dreaminess of what he was able to do also. I mean, people want to go around the world and eat and talk to strangers in a meaningful way and have it matter. And I mean, what he was doing with his show, in the end, his show wasn't, for me, it wasn't about food. It was just making connection after connection after connection after connection. And that's kind of what I find myself trying to do in these days, reaching out to people and having conversations and hugging my wife and my kid a lot. A lot of the things that making you sad and being in mourning cause you to do.
Yeah, true.
It's a great loss.
It really is. There's so many quotes.
And I didn't know him terribly. Yeah. You know, I mean, beyond our professional interactions and seeing each other at functions time to time and having some friends in common, this isn't, you know, somebody I was going out to dinner with every Sunday. So, you know, the extent to which I feel sad and you know, you feel sad, you think about those who are closest to him, and it just breaks my heart.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I keep thinking about Eric Repair and just and his family and people who were his dear friends.
Yeah.
And because, yeah, I've actually, I guess I've in a sense been surprised myself how emotional I have been.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's staying. It's not something I think it's going to go away anytime soon, or even maybe ever,
either.
You know,
I don't think so either. I mean, it's a lot about, you know, what you're talking about at the top of the show. It's like, you know, you try to find that moment of gratitude as solace. You know, you want to try to find it every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so many people have said to me, or I've heard say they wanted his life. They want to be Bourdain. I think we have to, you know, step back and think, you know, that comes in with my tip with the judging a book by its cover. Like, you just don't know what someone's going through.
Never know.
We really need to, you know, keep that in mind.
Never know. Yeah.
I thought I'd just read a little quote I wrote. I don't know. I have a bunch of his expressions. He has so many things he's written, but this one, you know, spoke out to me, and I saw a few people I'm friends with, post it, so I'm just going to read this. Travel isn't always pretty. It isn't always comfortable. Sometimes it hurts. It even breaks your heart. But that's okay. The journey changes you. It should change you. It leaves marks in your memory, on your consciousness, on your heart, and on your body. You take something with you. Hopefully, you leave something good behind. And that's from No Reservations Around the World on an Empty Stomach.
He was good. So yeah, good.
Really good. Well, my heart goes out to his family and friends, and okay, we're going to take another break, and then we're going to come back. We'll end the show with my solo dining experience and the final question. Stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Oh,
Welcome back to Only Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. This week it's at Holman & Finch Public House. Here's the rundown. The location, 2277 Peachtree Road, Northwest, Atlanta, Georgia. The concept, good food, good drinks, good people, centering around its community, a place to gather and enjoy a respite from the day. The proprietors, Chef Linton Hopkins and his wife Gina, Executive Chef Spencer Gomez. So why did I go? So last weekend I was down in Atlanta Food and Wine Festival, and I've always wanted to go to one of Linton's restaurants. This restaurant's part of Resurgence Hospitality Group, which is the name of his restaurant group, and they're staples in Atlanta. I'm also friends with Executive Pastry Chef Jennifer Yee, who used to live in New York, and I'm a fan of hers as well, and she's now down in Atlanta with him, and so I wanted to check out her desserts too, and I also know Culinary Director Damon Weiss, who's with the restaurant group, so I had lots of reasons to go. My experience. I went for a Sunday brunch, and I had a reservation for one. When I arrived, I was seated at a quaint two-top by the window in the intimate dining room. There were two servers that were tag-teaming my table in the whole room, and they were lovely. They had a tremendous amount of Southern charm and took good care of me. So what did I get? Well, I was tempted to get the H&F burger, which he's known for and it's popular, but the night before I had been out late at this spot, Marcel, in Atlanta, which I had their burger, and it was so damn good. I just couldn't have another burger yet. So instead, I went with the GA Royal Red Shrimp Toast, which is another fan favorite there. And it came with heirloom tomato, Creole cream, and spinach. And after, I had a coffee and Eton mess for dessert. So my take, the Creole cream sauce, which was rich and decadent, it soaked into the toast. It was delicious. It was worth the 10,000 calories or whatever it was. It was delicious. And then I really went decadent because I had this Eton mess, which is a traditional English dessert consisting of strawberries, meringue, and whipped double cream. And it was delicious and it had the freshest strawberries. So it felt a tiny bit healthy-ish, but really it was just an excuse to have more of that dessert when I was eating the strawberries. It was just delicious. The ambiance is a casual modern gastro pub with wood tables and big windows. And up front, you can peek through a big glass window into the kitchen. It's perfect for comfort food and Southern hospitality. Interesting tidbit. Anthony Bourdain on his Atlanta episode of The Layover, which aired on Travel Channel in January 2013. He featured Holman and Finch, stating it was designed expressly for the chefly sensibilities of other cooks and chefs and restaurant people. Now it's a hit with everybody. And that's true. Personal fun fact, I met up with Jennifer Yee the day before and we did a little restaurant hopping. We went to Cask and Ales Cafe, which I just read is closing now. So I'm glad I got there before it closed. We had a great lunch. We also stopped by their bakery Proof and Little Tart Bake Shop at Krog Street Market. I also went by this Pont Street Market, which was really cool. And there's an H&F burger place there. I think next time I'm down in Atlanta, I'm going to have to try that burger. So the cost was $27. To be fully honest, full disclosure, I was comped and I wasn't exactly sure what the coffee costs. But if I wasn't comped, it would have been about $27. But thank you so much to Jen and her team. I really appreciate them taking care of me. And it was a treat. So would I go back? Yes, I would. And their website's holman-finch.com. Have you ever been there?
I like Linton Hopkins.
Okay.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, I've met him at events, I think, here and there, but I don't know him super well. But I'd like to try his other places. I had events every night I was down there, so I couldn't go to Eugene or in the dinner places. So.
Busy.
Yeah.
Got to get back.
Yeah, got to get back. Okay, so let's do the final question. So next week, my guest is Alon Shaya. He is an award-winning chef and owner of Pomegranate Hospitality based in New Orleans. He has a new cookbook memoir out called Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. And he recently opened Saba in New Orleans and is opening Safta in Denver, his two new restaurants. So
grandma and grandpa means.
Yes, you got that. Of course, you're a journalist. You know this stuff.
It's more Hebrew school than journalism.
And good memory.
And good memory. So, yeah, that's cool. That'll be a fun guest. So I'm supposed to ask him a question.
Yes. What would you like to ask him?
It's kind of a hard question. I mean, Alon was involved in this this legal battle for his own name with his former boss, the disgraced John Besh. I'm wondering how one physically reacts to having to fight for their own name. Do you end up in the gym lifting more weight than ever before? Do you throw a shoe through a plate of glass? Do you just cook your face off and hope it all resolves? I want to know the immediate visceral response to that that lawsuit and how it ended up working out for him in the end, how you come to terms with something like that. I want the personal experience. I know we can't talk about the legal stuff, but he can in legal terms talk about how he felt about it, and I'd be really curious to hear about it.
I would too. Thank you for asking that question, because I can't imagine what it's like to be fighting for your name. Yeah,
I mean, I would have been furious. If I were him, you know, first of all, it's your own name, it's your reputation. You're trying to break off from somebody who's not someone you want to be associated with, someone who's done it wrong. And then there's a battle over it. So it kind of seems unjust in a way, but legal contracts and justice aren't always the same thing. And I don't know Alon at all, but I was thinking about him through that experience, because it's a weird one.
It is. And I mean, it's not the first chef to be fighting for their name.
No.
It's come up before.
And I think it's also like part of a bigger conversation about, you know, how do you split off from somebody who, you know, was partnered in with you in a way. And then that person is not someone you want to be associated with anymore. I mean, that whole kind of breaking up is something that's going on in a major way. In the food world right now, and in movie studios, and in corporate America, and elsewhere. So it's an interesting question for right now.
It's a very interesting question.
In this Me Too moment.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm excited to talk to him. I've met him. I've gotten to know him through going to lots of food and wine events, and usually seeing him in other cities. You know,
his food's delicious.
His food's delicious. Super nice guy. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan. And I'm looking forward to having him on.
I'm looking forward to hearing him.
Well, thank you. Well, that's the show. Thank you so much for coming on today and sharing all these stories with me.
It was a pleasure, Sherry. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no, we're going to talk more about Michigan memories, and congratulations on your whole career. We didn't get into it that much with as a writer. I feel as a freelance writer, I mean, it's a hustle. It's hard, and you've gotten bylines out there that are it's very impressive, the writing you've done.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. I look forward to reading your next byline.
Thank you, Sherry.
Okay, so my guest today has been Howie Kahn. He's a writer, a contributing editor at the Wall Street Journal, and he's the host and editor-in-chief of Prince Street Podcast. Y'all should check it out. And check out his new book, Sneakers. Available on Amazon.
And wherever books are sold.
You can also find Howie at his website, howiekahn.com, and on Instagram I have at howiekahn. You can find me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. Websites bayerpublicrelations.com and sherrybayer.com. All of our shows are archived at heritageradionetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks again to my guest, Howie.
Thank you.
Thanks to my engineer, Vitor Hirsch. And thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with another live show. I hope you'll tune in then. I'm Sherry Bayer. And that's it for this week. Have a good one. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.